if we want to ask, was business exploiting the workers? Well, that question is answered in nominal dollars.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Stefan Levera podcast, a show about Bitcoin and Austrian economics brought to you by Swan.com. Joining me today is Gene Epstein. He is the founder of the Soho Forum, and he was a longtime editor, economics editor at Barron's, and he's rejoining me on the show today. We're going to be talking about lots of interesting things. Gene, great to have you back.
Good to be back, and of course, good to get the opportunity to promote my Soho Forum among your millions of fans, Stefan.
Not quite that many, but yeah.
You get a free ticket. We charge $24 plus it's $8 for the party afterwards. We're having Jay Bhattacharya on Sunday, December 17th. It's going to be a matinee, and tickets are on sale for that. In February, we're having a debate on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And if you go into thesohoforum.org, tickets are on sale for all our debates through March. Jay Bhattacharya, especially whom you probably have heard of, is going to debate the successful case that he helped bring against the Biden administration for censorship, and he's going to be debating a lawyer, and that'll be a Sunday matinee. In addition, I want to emphasize that we have a twofold mission at the Soho Forum to have a debate, one-on-one debate of interest to libertarians, but hopefully to the larger community, but then to have a party afterwards where people can commune. Most of the time our debaters attend. In this case, both debaters will be at the party to discuss the issues afterwards. That's part of the show. People meet each other. They form friendships, careers, romances. They have sex afterwards. This is part of our mission to get people together, Stefan. So if you're passing through New York, you, your wife, and your nine-month-old on December 17th, you want to come to our debate. Your many listeners should be coming as well. There are lots of things to do in New York in December 17th. But as I say, there's the debate and the party afterwards. Thesohoforum.org is where you should look. All right, Stefan, I'm through. I'm done. That's it. Let's get to your questions. But
Let's talk a little bit about what we were planning to talk about. Now, the reason I wanted to chat with you again is I know you have a specific critique of a particular idea that seems to be prevalent right now, and that idea, and this is relevant for Bitcoiners as well, because I think a lot of Bitcoiners are aware of the website WTFHappenedIn1971.com. And at the top of that website is this infamous chart, which basically shows, basically the idea is to try to show, oh, wow, look at the divergence between labor productivity and labor compensation. And so people can see on the chart. But Gene, I know you have a very strong disagreement with this, and you have I think a lot of people who don't know you might sort of initially think, oh, wow, is this just like some lefty person who's sort of disagreeing? No, actually, Gene is a free market guy, and he's critiquing it for a different reason. So, Gene, I know you have a very specific framework to outline around this. So do you mind outlining some of your thoughts there?
Yes. As a matter of fact, bear in mind that I've made few friends with this critique of mine, as you call it, few because, as you probably know, Bitcoiners and other free market types like to argue that the government has so screwed up the economy that this divergence between productivity gains and wage gains actually did occur, and so many of them dated from the early 1970s, because for them, it's because whatever vestiges of the gold standard were retained up until then were abandoned, as you know. For foreigners, the dollar was redeemable in gold, and then Nixon, as the phrase goes, closed the gold window, and a lot of free marketeers said, that's why productivity kept increasing. but wages barely followed, lagged far behind. Indeed, I was just speaking to another interviewer, and I was saying that, you know, most people are doing better than their parents did. On all levels of income, things are improving, and I get a lot of pushback. So it's not just from the left, it's from the libertarians, from the free market people that I get this pushback. Now, ironically, my critique is so simple that one would might say it almost defies belief. I did an interview, I'll mention, with Bob Murphy, right? Some people said you got a little bit too quickly into the statistical weeds, and I lost you. You know, and it's a little bit hard to convey these points in just such a discussion. I did I hope you actually link to it. I did a lecture at the Mises Institute about a year ago, 2 years ago, actually, by now, in which I threw up some slides so that the graphs are fairly simple and I had plenty of time to explain it. But really, the whole point is quite simple. It's quite simple. And I want to begin it this way. There's nominal dollars. There are nominal dollar measures of productivity and of labor compensation. I should say, of course, labor compensation includes benefits. The cockamamie chart you sent me from the Economic Policy Institute seems to include benefits as well. So we don't have to get into that argument. Benefits, mainly medical benefits, pension benefits, and so on. That's part of your salary. It would be money you'd spend out of your salary if the benefits weren't provided. So that's compensation. Okay. So take compensation and take the measure of output per worker hour, both of them measured in nominal dollars. Now, what are nominal dollars? Nominal dollars are simply a measure of what business sells the output for. It's always selling it in nominal dollars. In 1972, 73, 74, 97, 98, it's always selling its output in nominal dollars, and it's always paying compensation in nominal dollars. Now, if you then take output per worker hour in nominal dollars each year, take compensation in nominal dollars each year, you're lining them up each year together. And that means then that you'll simply ask a question like, well, did the increase in nominal dollars paid workers in compensation track the increase in nominal dollars in the output per labor hour? Did they track each other? The answer is, however you measure the productivity and the compensation, according to the website of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is the official arbiter of these numbers, the answer is yes, the two tracked each other. Tracked each other in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and in every decade since, up okay. through the present.
Yeah.
Not so exactly,
just,
not
just
precisely.
To make sure everybody's following along. Basically, what you're making. Yeah, you're making the point that when you put everything into nominal dollar terms, productivity and labor compensation have actually, in fact, tracked each other, and that there's another reason for this supposed divergence on this chart. Which,
Well, see, what I'm trying to do is bring it down to earth. What I'm trying to say is that I'm not exactly saying anything very sophisticated here. I'm not massaging numbers, really. Although I will tell you that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, when they post their numbers, the agency posts its numbers, it takes a little bit of manipulation to put the numbers in nominal dollars, They don't. I mean, it's not like it's. I'm not exactly a statistical whiz, but I can do it because I'm familiar with the numbers. But you have to do a little bit of a manipulation, and it's simple enough. Nominal dollars. And my point is that the rest is bullshit. The rest is just how do these fanatics take nominal dollars? If the Bureau of Liberty would only say dollar for dollar each year, and again, I emphasize, why does it make sense? Well, business sells in nominal dollars and people are paid in nominal dollars. So why are we messing with this? We want to match one with the other. Why do we have to inflation adjust these numbers when we're comparing nominal dollars with nominal dollars? And by the way, there are other, any sophisticated person, and now I have to use the word sophisticated, should know that price indexes are a bit of a can of worms. We can argue about them endlessly. They're very gross approximations. Murray Rothbard, an economist I revere, wrote in Man, Economy, and State, the book that was my gateway, my to libertarianism, that price indexes are all bullshit. Although Murray Rothbard, whenever he needed to use a price index, did use it, so he was a little bit hypocritical. In this case, we don't need to use a price index because we're comparing the dollar in the nominal dollar value of what was out, what was made, with the nominal dollar value of what was paid to workers. We don't need to use a price index. So that should be the end of it. We don't have to bother with this anymore. We then have to unravel why people like the Economic Policy Institute folks have turned this thing into an entangled mess with price indexes, or why the Bureau of Labor Statistics does it as well. We only have to ask, what is wrong with these people that they can't think in simple terms? I believe that in the case of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it's a combination of a very strong sort of left-wing tradition that they use price indexes when the price indexes only confuse, they do not clarify. In addition, it's a kind of a bureaucratic inertia. But I think that I got to know some of those people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and they sort of like the idea of showing that there's a huge divergence between productivity and compensation that started in the early 1970s. Okay. I hope now if you take away nothing else from what I'm about to say, it's what I've just maybe belabored. The nominal dollar measures, which are easy to come by, which I post over and over again anytime I'm asked. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics has different, by the way, it's actually, the fact that they line up is almost like, I almost regard it as miraculous, because these numbers are to some degree statistical sausages. And if you actually unravel the standard measure of compensation, usually the preferred measure is non-farm productivity and then non-farm wages. And I could get into non-farm compensation. I should have said wages, compensation. I get into the complications there, but they do line up. So case closed, who cares? Now you sent me the graph of the Economic Policy Institute. And of course, the main thing to say about that graph, although the other things to say about how screwed up it is, but the main thing to say about that graph, as well as all of the others that are posted, is that they're dealing in two sets of books. What do I mean by that? They're using two different divergent price indexes for compensation versus output. That's the only reason why they get that result. They're using If for compensation, they use typically the consumer price index. I'm not sure it says that in the graph that you just sent me, but I'm sure that's what they're using, the consumer price index. In the case of output, they're using something called the implicit price deflator, a very different measure. Now, those two indexes sharply diverged starting in the early 1970s. If you want to make something of that if you believe the implicit price deflator as a way of measuring the real output per worker hour versus the CPI versus the real wage, that's fine. If you want to say, well, something interesting happened, the value of the output was priced differently from what workers had to pay in order to make ends meet. I don't know if I've lost you there. My point is that the price indexes diverge, and somebody could say, well, but that's the reality if you believe in the price indexes. Price indexes, as I say, are statistical sausages. They're very screwed up. I happen to believe, along with the Brookings Institution, that the consumer price index still overstates price inflation by nearly one percentage point a year, but that's not important in this case. The point is that if you want to say that the value of the output increased because of the different price index faster than the cost of living based on our price index, you could say that and you could make something of it. You could discuss it. But that evades the question. The question is, was business exploiting labor? Was business paying labor so much less than the value of the output? That question is answered through nominal dollars. As a guy I know who's got a lot of experience with the BLS and with the Bureau of Economic Analysis, Bureau of Labor Statistics, Bureau of Economic Analysis, they throw up these numbers and they don't realize if this is really the case, that the exploitation rate just really hit the moon, that productivity soared and compensation barely followed, profits must have been going through the roof. The fact of the matter is that profits did not go through the roof, which is, by the way, another interesting story in itself. But the point is, they don't ask, my God, the windfall must have done, but they don't trace it out. But again, they're not curious about it because they're happy with their results. So again, back to square one. If we want to ask, was business exploiting the workers? Well, that question is answered in nominal dollars. No, they increased compensation pretty much in line in nominal dollars with the value of the output in nominal dollars. So no, there was not some big break. There was no great departure starting in 1971 where labor was suddenly getting exploited and not getting paid the nominal dollar value of their output. Again,
yeah, okay.
I keep beating the same dead horse because I found that when I started by saying, oh, well, they're using different price indexes and getting people into the weeds, they get a little bit confused. So maybe we ought to go over it again. But again, I hope I made the point.
Yeah, no, I think I've got you. So let me just summarize.
Enough. It's all bullshit. It is not even anything for me to say that I'm respectfully challenging these people. I am saying they have their heads up their asses. I am saying that they have such an ideological stake in this result that it doesn't occur to them to say, let's do it in nominal dollars. Now there are more subtle problems with the EPI measure. And again, because I think they have a particular stake in their result. But you know, I'll interrupt myself again and say that probably if I were talking with an API person and I said that the API person would probably say, but look, the price indexes are the price indexes. So our price, so the price index of productivity diverges, and so productivity is taken off. And so the real value of the output took off, and the real value of the compensation didn't. I'm sure that I would never convince that kind of hardhead that's an interesting story itself, but it doesn't address the exploitation issue.
Gotcha.
The nominal dollar issue addresses it.
Yeah. So I think this is an interesting one for Bitcoiners, because a lot of Bitcoiners have kind of been making this argument. They've been out there saying, look, you know, the Federal Reserve and taking the, you know, closing the gold window and all these typical arguments. Now, there may be arguments that are correct, but maybe just not this particular one about labor exploitation, right? So I think as Austrians, you can definitely make the argument about the Cantillon effect, right? This idea that, you know, those people who are closer to the money printer, they are winning and the savers are losing in this fiat inflationary system. And well, I think those arguments still apply.
There's lots of things. But the argument about the connection between this exploitation, essentially, neoclassical economics, not just the Austrians, but neoclassical economics also says, the standard mainstream economics also says that labor as a whole will be compensated, that increases in compensation will pretty much pace the increase in the value of the productivity of labor. That this will be a strong tendency year to year. It's not perfect, but it will happen. And so, indeed, this departure, this huge divergence, indicates something very dramatic happened to American capitalism. The left wing likes to say it's the decline of unions, I guess, that did it, among other things, or then maybe later on the idea that there was a competition from cheap labor abroad. My fellow Austrians and free marketeers, I think, are a little bit incoherent about it, because I've never really heard any convincing argument. Maybe you could give me one about the causal connection between the closing of the gold window and the takeoff of price inflation and this huge divergence. You know, how was it in a competitive labor market that workers were suddenly not that compensation suddenly was so far lagging increases in productivity? You know, Ludwig von Mises and others explain it much pretty clearly that if labor is really getting that if is usually underpaid in a particular sector, then competition will bid the wage up, because I can take all your workers from you because they're producing so much more. I can make a huge profit by just bidding up the wage. So that's the standard argument against unions, that even Joseph Stiglitz, this progressive economist, others point out that unions only cause differentials in wages. Unions don't lift wages. Productivity lifts wages. There's pretty much of a consensus about that.
Back to the show in a moment. If you need a place to stack sats, swan.com is the place to go. I work at Swan, and Swan makes it really easy for you to buy Bitcoin and also learn about Bitcoin. And you can do this over at swan.com on the website, or using Swan Bitcoin's apps that are available for Apple or Android smartphones. With Swan, it's easy to set up an automated recurring purchase plan, because Bitcoin is quite volatile, and stacking sats for the longer term is actually the way that many people have done well out of this. And Swan makes it easy for you to do this, because you can stack sats in an automated recurring way, and you can even withdraw those sats in an automated way. And withdrawals are free at Swan. Swan wants you to self-custody your coins. And with Swan, there's a range of learning and material available to you, whether that is Swan Signal, whether that is additional private research for Swan private customers. There's so much that you can explore over at swan.com. And if you go to swan.com/Livera, you'll get $10 of Bitcoin dropped into your account when you start stacking with Swan. And now back to the show with Gene. Yeah, and I'm saying I'm agreeing with you on that particular point about, you know, I think this notion of the disconnection between the labor productivity and labor compensation is not correct, as you're saying, because when you put it in nominal, it's all the same. But yeah. I think maybe the point where other, where maybe there's still, you know, I'm curious to hear your views on this as well, is I think a lot of people would argue that CPI is understating inflation and that actually people are, you know, there's a cost of living crisis, and that's, and I'm sure you're seeing this as okay. well, but well, I'm curious to hear your view on that.
We can get into that. All right. As you said, we've sort of kissed off the issue about this exploitation phenomenon that the whole idea that compensation tends to increase with productivity got rescinded. Capitalism suddenly abrogated that tendency, something, and we know that this is simply not true. Okay. I could mention, by the way, that the EPI likes to take their own construction, the Economic Policy Institute, so I'm referring to the Left Wing Institute, they like to take their own construction, and they like to make it the wages and benefits of production and non-supervisory workers. In other words, they don't take the entire compensation figure that is posted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They take out this portion that they get for production and non-supervisory workers. And there's another more subtle scandal in that number. The Bureau of Labor Statistics itself repudiated that figure years ago, the idea that you can actually track production and non-supervisory worker payouts. Maybe that's an interesting thing to get into, but it looks like maybe you're not that interested in it. The fact is that there's a slight scandal going on. In my book, Econo Spinning, I quoted a landmark statement from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that was posted, I guess it was in 2005. They said that they were discontinuing the series on wages of production and non-supervisory workers. They said they were discontinuing it, and they explained why they were discontinuing it. And then, lo and behold, they brought out the larger figure of for all workers, but they decided not to discontinue the production and non-supervisory workers number.
I see. As I understand, then this kind of comes down to how you count what kind of workers. And so I think is that the point you're making around the supervisory workers versus the all employees number?
Yes. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, I quoted the statement in my book, but maybe best for me to summarize it. The scandal about that number was that it started, the production numbers started back in the 1940s, and it conjured up what was a reasonable demarcation that if you send a questionnaire to a factory, an establishment that is a factory, and it probably can fill out the pay it gives to the production workers versus the workers that are supervising versus the foreman. But then what increasingly happened, of course, over time, was that we're not really sending out questionnaires to the production versus the supervisory work. We're sending it out to service industries. And they found that the respondents were leaving that part blank. As I jokingly said, I work at Barron's, and when I wrote about this in my column, I work at Barron's, and I can guarantee you that whoever fills out the form that is sent by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, what did you pay your non-supervisory workers? They do not spend a whole lot of time worrying about whether Gene Epstein is a supervisory or a non-supervisory workers. They don't know, because do I supervise some people? Yeah. Am I supervised by others? Yeah. Well, the fact of the matter is that they were finding that so many companies were simply leaving that part blank. The Bureau of Labor Statistics then had to deal with very skimpy returns on that part of the question, because increasingly companies were simply saying, this doesn't mean anything to us. The further joke is that when you looked it up at the Bureau of Labor Statistics glossary, they said people who are non-supervisory are people who are not in a supervisory position, meaning then they defined it in a circular way. So the whole thing became a left-wing joke. And what I added to the insight was, why was it that this wage figure for non-supervisory workers was so flat? Why was it lagging other wage figures that were coming from other sources? My theory, which I originated in my book, was that because the companies that paid people best, that were giving average workers stock options, that were giving raises to people, that were mixing it up, these were the companies that were paying the best. And so the companies that were being missed in the survey was the increasing share of the better paying companies who had no such definition anymore.
Yeah, okay. I think, that's probably more into kind of the statistical weeds, but I think it'll be more interesting to hear your views on CPI and how you think CPI is actually understating inflation. Most, you know, people are probably thinking CPI rather is understating inflation, and you actually believe it's overstating the perceived inflation. I'm curious why you believe that.
Well, let me give one broader statement. This might shock you, but the CPI, given the way the formula works, completely missed the Walmart effect and completely missed the Amazon effect. I would be getting into the weeds in order to explain why. But when Walmart came along, and especially in the grocery area, they came along in all the other goods areas, Walmart specialized in selling name brand goods and then in selling food at huge discounts. And the CPI, the way it was technically set up, just linked to those numbers, I'll put that in quotes, linked to those numbers, and never registered the huge discounts that were brought. And so there was no decline in prices that was ever recorded from this. Same thing with Amazon. Amazon brought about huge discounts of books and other things, made it possible for people to buy things for less. That too was missed. So those are two sort of major events in discounting that they simply were unable to handle because of the way the formula works. So that in itself should be a little bit of a shock. What else is involved? They tend to come, I guess, if you look at the history of, let me give the other dramatic example. They didn't know how to handle the smartphone. The smartphone revolution was really extraordinary in that it hit hard during the Great Recession, 08, 09. People were suddenly throwing away those clip phones that became sort of collector's items or niche items, and they were suddenly buying smartphones. And the smartphone replaced so much. Most young people I know don't own watches. I mean, maybe the clip-on phone was keeping... No, I guess it wasn't keeping time. Most people I know, they don't own flashlights. They don't use a desktop computer or a laptop. They just use their smartphone as a computer. All of the many goods and services that a smartphone provided were simply not reflected in the numbers. Now, again, if I would explain it further, I would be getting into the weeds. But you recognize that the smartphone had a huge deflationary effect since it substituted for so many goods and services. And then, of course, obviously it meant you no longer needed to use a landline. Most young people I know don't own a landline phone anymore.
Right.
The obviously the camera. Don't buy a camera anymore. all of these goods and goods that are part of the CPI suddenly become sort of like lame ducks, and it's all encapsulated in the smartphone. A huge and of course the smartphone was pricey, but the bundle of goods that it brought was a huge disinflationary effect. And the CPI missed.
So, I mean, look, granted that, you know, the smartphone and the internet and, you know, some of these things.
And Walmart.
Yeah. Well, I'm not an American, so I'm probably not as familiar with that. But yeah, sure.
And Amazon, you want to grant that as well?
Yeah, of course. Certainly. I agree with you on that. But do you not? I mean, I'm sure you also hear a lot of people who are also complaining about the cost of living, that, you know, meat prices have risen so much in the recent years, and you know there are these alternative indexes. So, as an example, the Chapwood Index is one example. But I'm curious, do you see, like, how much can you account for that with the, as you said, the Walmart effect, the Amazon, the smartphone effect? But how much? I mean, I can't eat my smartphone, right? Like, there's a certain amount of cost of food and cost of, you know, petrol for the car or things.
Stefan, let's slow down a second. I'm sorry. I just got to explaining to you that Walmart is major in the food business, in the grocery business. There was a major paper published about how Walmart started to discount groceries in a major way. I live in Manhattan, so I don't experience it, but when I'm on the road, the stunning grocery stores that they run, the supermarkets, that's food. They discounted it substantially. So let's make sure that I'm talking about necessities as well. Now, so you might say, look, I'm giving a few anecdotes. I can't give you a chalkboard demonstration of why the CPI misses it. I'm only giving you some major examples. And sure, food is indeed a major example of that, because Walmart is major in food. It, of course, it forced discounting from other grocery stores, other supermarkets as well. But let me get to the Chapwood Index, which I actually, in my ignorance, I'd never heard of, but I looked it up. I thought there's another guy, I forget his name. These alternative indexes have a certain reductio ad absurdum nature about them. And what is that reductio ad absurdum nature? It's that if you apply, and actually I looked it up, I'm not the first one to make this critique or the only one. It's an obvious enough one that if you apply the Chapwood Index and if you believe in it, we have not had an economic expansion for the last 10 years. We've had nothing but contraction. You know why? Because obviously if you then take, now, of course, maybe you're not going to believe in nominal GDP. If you take nominal gross domestic product and then you apply any version of the Chapwood Index to it in order to turn it into real gross domestic product, you get a continual contraction because nominal gross domestic product never rose more than 4%, 5% at most, and the Chapwood was rising at more than 5% consistently. So we've had nothing but contraction. Now, I'm able to meet people who say, yeah, well, that's right. We've had nothing but contraction. We are poorer than we used to be. Well, the problem with believing that that gross output or whatever amount of measure you want of output has been contracting is that there are so many other independently derived numbers that contradict that, mainly employment numbers. We have universal counts of employment from unemployment insurance claims. We have other counts of the actual quantity of goods sold and manufactured. We have reasonable verification of the fact that there has been economic expansion. And the difference between the Chapwood Index and the nominal GDP is now so great that it's just impossible to believe the Chapwood Index has any basis in reality for that reason alone. Now, so that's why these alternative indexes are deeply unimpressive. I'll go back to the obtuseness. Again, these are arguments that are so silly For me to belabor the refutation almost dignifies such arguments. Now, with respect to my more subtle point about the idea that the CPI still tends to overstate inflation, now that's a little bit more subtle. I've made only a few general points about where it makes mistakes, but more broadly, the problem with any price index is that if you have an entrepreneurial economy where discounting happens, where fortunes are made from discounting, if you have an entrepreneurial economy where new products are coming out, it's very hard for a price index to keep up with it. And by the way, I as you know, I began by saying that to whatever extent you can avoid using a price index, I would avoid using it. I would tell you, by the way, that you can take wages as a share, compensation as a share of output. That's much better because that's a nominal versus a nominal. I would not use a price index for wages. I prefer not to. So I want to avoid price indexes to whenever it's necessary. But price indexes at times become unavoidable. Let me make a more general point as well about what I believe is the psychology of the way people perceive prices. There are two issues. Number one, in the life cycle, as people get older, they tend to buy more expensive goods. They tend to buy, so they become sort of more aware of the fact that things seem to cost more than they used to. That's part of it. But secondly, I believe that people will tend to notice a price hike more quickly than they'll notice a price decline, or more quickly than they'll notice a flat price. They'll become aware of price hikes more easily than they will of price declines. So I think that's the reason why there's a kind of a bias in that people tend to suffer from with respect to their perception about what is happening to prices.
I think it seems interesting to me because we're seeing people who are, you know, there's a lot of people talking about even the same item. You know, let's say ribeye steak or something like that has, you know, that has gone up more.
Hey, look, I mean, again, I ribeye steak. I mean, we could get into another subtle issue here, but the question is, the CPI. Oh yeah, let me just look it up. I mean, the CPI certainly shows that steak and meat is a lot more expensive. It's not like it doesn't. That's not a difficult item to track. Except, as I say, they missed the discounting that Walmart was opposing. But still, they definitely show an increase.
Yeah. So I guess at the end of the day, it sort of comes down to what's in your basket. And of course, everybody's basket is different in terms of the real goods and services that you actually purchase. But I guess, does that then explain, because we're seeing a lot of people who are saying, hey, I can't make ends meet. It seems that, you know, and we seem to be seeing a lot more conversation about cost of living crisis. Do you put that all down to that effect that you were saying, that just basically people notice increases more than they notice decreases? Is that the main factor that's going on here?
As I say, the additional point is that there's a certain life cycle issue where people going from their 20s to their 30s, they want more things. They have trouble making ends meet because their expectations rise. They buy more expensive items. I was going to look up meat, but I guess there's no point. The CPI definitely shows a huge increase in meat. And of course, let me emphasize, I posted a tweet just the other day where I took the CPI because the CPI over the last, just uniformly, I took the CPI, which is the official measure the Bureau of Labor Statistics takes. And then I took this Bureau of Labor Statistics measure of not the average hourly wage of the production supervisory workers, which is, as I mentioned, a screwed up number, but of all workers, which is what they've been tracking. And I found that if you compare the real hourly wage in October of 2023 last month's number, the most recent number, that is now inflation adjusted by the CPI, and then the same CPI inflation adjusting over the last 7 years. And then compare October of 2023 with February of 2020, 44 months ago. Why did I take February of 2020? Because it's the month before the lockdown started. It's the month before the U.S., the governments of the states shut the economy down. The last month when there was when something was happening in the economy, and then the lockdowns occurred. So compared to February of 2020, 44 months ago, according to their official numbers, the average hourly earnings are up by just 4 cents. 4 cents. Now take the same 44-month periods in 2019, 2018, 2017, and the rise was about 40 cents. So I make that point because there are a whole lot of cheerleaders out there, Paul Krugman among them, for the Biden economy. And I began this tweet by saying, well, maybe this is a reason why people aren't too excited about the Biden economy, about the performance of the economy. There's just been, according to the official numbers, a 4 cent increase. Now, I do think the CPI is understating, but bear in mind that I'm making a comparison according to the same, I mean, overstating rather, but according to the same CPI measure, it used to be 40 cents. Over 44 months, not 4 cents. So even if I'm correct, by the way, I'm just saying the CPI overstates by a little less than 1 percentage point a year. So if inflation is running 4, 5, 6%, as it has been, that's not a huge difference in terms of overstatement. The only main issue about the overstatement of the CPI has to do with the very long run, that if you're going to look at 15, 20, 30-year periods, a 1%, a 0.9 percentage point difference makes a difference, but not over 44 months, not so much, or even not so much over 44 months. Why do I make that point? Because I'm trying to, of course, point out to you that I'm hardly ignorant of the fact that price inflation has taken off. It's been punishing a whole lot of people. The gains over the last 44 months, according to the CPI, have been a mere 4 cents. Even if I'm right about the overstatement, it's been maybe 5 cents or 5.5 cents over 44 months, when it used to be over 40 cents. So that's been bad news. And indeed, there too, I get, I'm really sounding like a curmudgeon, forgive me, I'll slow down, calm down a little bit here, but there was a huge explosion in the conventional measure called M2,
right,
that began in early 2020. By any means, an explosion that completely dwarfed the last time there were spikes in the 1970s. There were spikes in the 1970s that connected to the price inflation then. Then the increase in M2 greatly slowed, and then starting in early 2020, M2 exploded on the upside. M2 is the measure of the money supply adopted pretty much by the Chicago monetarists. It's a measure of cash plus checks plus a lot of near monies like savings accounts. It's the well-accepted measure of the money supply, and it exploded. Big news, hardly surprising that price inflation took off. And now M2 has greatly slowed its increase. So much of the only reason why my, again, as I mentioned, the only reason why my idea that the CPI overstates inflation matters is because of using it as a long-term measure, not in the short run. So people have a right to complain about. Although, I was just interviewed by somebody who claimed I was being a Pollyanna by even suggesting that the average hourly earnings are up by 4 to 5 cents over the last 44 months. That there has been some modest increase, a very modest increase, but if people are used to 40 cents, then a lot of people are hurting. A lot of people in their own life cycles are hurting. So indeed.
Right. Yeah. Back to the show in a moment. If you're trying to transact recently, I'm sure you've seen the dynamics in the mempool can be a bit tricky. Mempool.space is your way to help navigate what's going on here. With mempool.space, you can see at a glance the mempool dynamics and see how much of a fee you need to attach to your transaction to get it confirmed into a block. With mempool.space, you can view the mempool, you can view the blockchain, the historical record of transactions. You can see data relating to those transactions, such as whether it was part of a multi-signature, whether it relates to a lightning channel, the RBF history of that transaction. There's all kinds of information you can dive into there. And with mempool.space, you don't even have to trust a third party because it's free and open source software. You can host it yourself, you can run it yourself. And don't forget, this has been coming for some time, but the Mempool Accelerator is coming soon. So keep an eye out for that. This is going to be a really awesome tool, and I'll be getting Wiz and Simon on the show soon to talk about it. So go and find out more over at mempool.space. With Bitcoin, it's not your keys, not your coins. And at CoinKite.com, you can get a range of tools that will help you with securing your coins. So, for example, we often need hardware devices to help secure our coins and keep them in a way that's more secure. Now, the way this is done is by locking down devices such that they don't have Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, as an example. So you can get a cold card, and this can help you create your Bitcoin private keys, and you can also use it to sign Bitcoin transactions, or in other words, spend Bitcoin if you need to. Now, the cold card is an easy device to use. I think a lot of people overplay how difficult it is, but in reality, if you just get a cold card and a USB-C cable and you plug it into the computer and you use it with software such as Sparrow Wallet or Spectre Desktop, you can follow the instructions on your cold card, and it's a relatively simple setup from there to generate an address and then use that address to receive Bitcoin. Now go to CoinKite.com and use code Livera to order your cold card, and you can see a range of devices and guides over there available on the website. And now back to the show. And one other idea that I'm curious to get your view on, it, you know, this is like another, I guess, pop culture thing. We're seeing people talk about this idea that, oh, it used to be possible to be a single breadwinner and have, you know, the wife and kids at home and this kind of thing. And would you put that down to people's expectations has risen so much that they believe it's not possible to do that anymore? Or do you think there's some genuine, you know, something wrong there that it used to be feasible? Where are you at here?
You know, I'm turning 79 in a few days, so just bear with me. Bear with the fact that I'm sounding like a real curmudgeon. I apologize for sounding so insulting toward my intellectual adversaries, but of course, here too, I would say the same thing. You know, people's expectations. You know, look, the fact is that I do have the advantage of being 79, that I grew up in the 1950s and early 1960s, and certainly it's also possible to show that that if you wanted to support a family on a single income, according to the standards, living standards of 1960, if you'll take that year, that's a decent year, then you'll never make a long distance phone call. You'll own a house. If you live in a house that's like half the size of the house you're in now, you won't have access to air conditioning. You'll never fly on a plane. Your diet will be much more restricted. There's air conditioning, there are planes. What else is there? The diseases like leukemia, will kill you. Leukemia is no longer a death sentence. It certainly was in 1960, and so the whole basket of goods and the whole expectation of how people live in 1960 was so much different. And I guess people have expectations, so they because it is true that there are so many double income families. Women enter the workplace and their husbands are working, and so they're used to living on those two incomes. But if they want to live the way their parents lived back in 1960, then they can afford to do it on one income. It's, you know, of course, obviously you'll be disconnected. You'll own a black and white TV that will be on the fritz half the time. You'll have to smack it in order to get it to work. As I say, your car will rust out. You won't have any air conditioning in your car when on a hot day. You won't have any. You'll go to the movies or to the beach in order to escape the heat, because amazingly the movie theaters were able to bring out air conditioning early on through some technology. That's where people fled during the heat waves. No air conditioning on the subways where I am. So a very different standard of living. People got by, but again, it just shows ignorance of history that people can actually talk in those terms. You used to be able to support a family on one income, and indeed, obviously, the wife did stay home and oftentimes didn't have a job. Most of the time, didn't have a job, and now oftentimes the wife does, even when the kids are going to school. So basically, that's the answer to that question. It is indeed also based on ignorance.
So I wonder then, is it also just a factor of social and cultural expectations, right? Maybe in years gone by, you might have had kids and not every kid had their own bedroom, right? Like that was, whereas nowadays it sort of seems the expectation almost seems, oh, every kid has to have their own bedroom. Mm-hmm. Like as mm-hmm. just as an example, right? That's one example of where families needed much bigger houses, or at least, today would need a much bigger house to have a big family, theoretically, under that, if you follow that. I don't necessarily agree with that. I only have one kid, but I'm, once I have multiple kids, I'm okay with them sharing rooms, especially when they're younger. But, but I think that's an example of a social difference.
Every kid needs his own smartphone, indeed. And, of course, and there are more cars than there are people. I mean, every kid needs his own car. Yeah, indeed. Obviously, it is the revolution of rising expectations, pretty much, that I guess all people think is that if you and your wife both have a job, both work, and then if you think about how would you live if only one of you were working, you'd have to cut back. And then the logic then goes that, well, then you can't support a family on one income anymore. But of course, as I said, it's almost impossible, ironically, it's almost difficult to replicate the way people lived in 1960, because, of course, part of the subtle issue here, I guess, is that if you don't own a smartphone, if you don't own some kind of, if you're not connected to the internet, you're not a part of society anymore. And so, therefore, you might say that in a way, what I'm arguing is sort of academic, because it's like, you're obliged to do it.
Right, like that it's not feasible to actually go back to the 1960s. Yeah, basically you're saying you could sort of make this argument that it's not feasible to actually go back to that standard because today you sort of have to have a smartphone to sort of operate in many jobs or many contexts.
Yeah, and maybe, I mean, can you find a car that rusts? Can you find a car like the cars in the 1960s? Can you find a car that has no air conditioning? Can you? I mean, again, I guess that's part of the point. Yeah. Although, I guess you agree with me that while all that, I think it's been even called something by economists, something like the neighborhood effect, which forces you to have a higher standard of living if you're going to become a part of society. And I think it's a significant point to make. On the other hand, I imagine you agree with me. At least it's a very different kind of point from the one people are usually making, which is that, like I'm poorer than my parents were. They could support you could support a family in those days. They're thinking in different terms. On the other hand, there is a certain reality to their point in the sense that we've just explained.
Right. Yeah. And maybe another angle is around regulation, right? That maybe, as an example, maybe there's government regulations that stop houses below a certain size or cars without certain functions, or some of these government regulations may even impact licensing and your ability to get a job, because maybe they say, oh, you're not allowed to be a babysitter until you've done XYZ, this regulation, that regulation, whatever, whereas maybe historically people just had the kid next door be the babysitter or something. I'm just making an example, but the regulations that impact occupational licensing, maybe that's also a factor that we've just seen this big bloat over time, and that's also what's driven the cost and the affordability up.
Well,
or down.
You strike a responsive chord in me, when I say that, there has been an explosion in occupational licensing, and it's all 99% corrupt. It's affected a lot of low-level industries. I don't think there should be occupational licensing. I don't think there should be restrictive licensure, even for medicine. You know, when Milton Friedman in 1962 published Capitalism and Freedom, his first book on the free market, and he went after restrictive licensure, he chose medicine as his example because he said, if I can convince you that there should be no restrictive licensure in medicine, then I imagine you can accept the other categories as well. That, of course, we want certification. We want agencies, and we want private sector agencies telling us this is a legitimately trained doctor recognized by his or her peers. But restrictive licensure is something else. It has taken off. Just to become a funeral assistant or a beautician or a manicurist, difficult to get those jobs. I think it has, unless you go through training, and that, of course, is just the corruption of the guild system, or to become a florist. There's never been any good explanation as to how they perform a service. There's no question we'd always want, again, we'd want certification, but not restriction. That yeah. has caused, that has exacerbated income inequality. And although even if you have a job, even the poorest paid people are doing better than the poorest paid people did 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
But another crucial part of it, since you struck a responsive chord in me, that's even more important, is the explosion in the restriction on housing, on the building of housing in high-wage areas that started in the 1960s. And interestingly, while the New York Times will inveigh against it that housing is so expensive, and that in New York and San Francisco and L.A., because of the zoning restrictions imposed by government and other restrictions imposed on the ability to build, they don't connect the dots and recognize that it has a huge effect on wage distribution. Because if you are in the $40,000 to $50,000 a year category, then your ability to move to a high-wage area is very restricted because of the cost of housing. If you're in the 100,000-plus category, the housing will pinch, but you can afford to take advantage of the high-wage jobs in the high-wage areas. So that, too, has been a major contribution to the maldistribution of income, the greater inequality of income among workers. And those are the two forms of inequality that we free marketeers, we libertarians also object to. Not specifically because it causes inequality, but specifically because it is unjust and it causes it denies people economic opportunities that they deserve in a free market. Yeah.
This is another point that we're seeing now, because we're seeing like this generational conflict, let's say, right? Like, not kinetic, but just they're sort of politically arguing. There's arguments in different parts of the world saying, oh, look, you know, and as an example, millennials are arguing against boomers, saying, oh, look, see, these boomers, they had it easy or easier, and maybe they've then sort of raised the ladder up behind them because maybe they've, to the point about property, maybe they've engaged in quote-unquote NIMBYism to block development of new housing, which in turn kind of keeps the house pricing high, which kind of locks or kind of keeps people unable to access property, right? That's kind of an argument that we're seeing.
Well, to clarify, again, you said NIMBYism. I always wanted to define our term. NIMBYism stands for not in my backyard. For those of your listeners who aren't familiar with the term, but I always want to emphasize that it is true, of course, that the average homeowner favors the NIMBYism, but you can only do it through the power of your government. The government is the agency through which you can do this, and that's why I want to say I'm not blaming it. I can blame it on the people, but I also want to emphasize that it is basically a government-imposed restriction.
Oh, and of course, yeah.
To update your point a little bit, what's also happened, again, because of the runaway price inflation that was truly a scourge and is still eating into the salaries of people, even though, as I say, the average is 4 cents higher. You know, it's not it's not lower. It's a little bit higher. I was wrong about expecting a recession this year. It's been a very slow expansion, but there has been some expansion. The other part of it, of course, is that the huge hike in the mortgage interest rate, in a matter of months, has meant that there are people with 3% mortgages, and then now suddenly the young people who want to buy their first home are facing 7 to 8% mortgages, and that's been a huge wrench in the economy due to the price inflation that the Federal Reserve brought about. Although it was of course the Treasury, and of course it had to do with the lockdowns. The lockdowns meant that the Treasury, U.S. Treasury, started to spend trillions of dollars that it showered into the economy. It ran trillions of dollars worth of debt, and that debt was bought through printed money by the Federal Reserve. That caused an explosion in M2, which brought the price inflation, and people of limited means are paying for it. And so that's been the story. I'm often walking a tightrope where I sound like a Pollyanna, and I want to make sure that people recognize that I do understand all of the injustices that are imposed mainly by government on people.
Of course.
And as a free marketeer, of course, I believe that that 99% of the goals of progressives are best realized through a free market. And that in a free market, we would have less income inequality and less wealth inequality. The trillions that were printed by the government made a lot of people very wealthy, including Jeff Bezos, because Amazon became so important. Amazon played an important role during the lockdowns, if the lockdowns had to happen, but it certainly greatly enriched him, and the lockdowns never really did have to happen, in my view.
Right, of course, yeah. And I think to clarify, yeah, certainly I agree with you about the government being the issue in many of these cases where, well, you know, even this intergenerational conflict, some of that argument is also because they're sort of saying, well, hang on, look at you, this generation above us who controlled the government and used the government to sort of make it harder for other, you know, to sort of make it easy for yourself and, you know, live for today and push the cost off to the younger generations. That's, you know, that's part of the argument, I think.
I'm fascinated by the, you know, we have a huge surplus of office space, and I'm fascinated by the potential for the office space to be converted to residences. And oddly, you know, one of the limitations that I almost never read about is the rule that every room in an apartment has to have a window. You know, I'm speaking to you from an office without a window. I live in a loft apartment with my wife, and we have, and my wife bought the loft apartment in 1981. I married her years later. She's an artist. And one of those rooms does not have a window. You know, hopefully we won't get arrested. You know, is it possible for people to actually, you know, when you mentioned regulation, you can't live in a place without a window. You know, I mean, I'm in an office without a window. A window is very nice, but it just doesn't matter to me that much. And offices are, so the point is that's a good example of the way regulation just screws things up. Windows are nice, but for somebody of limited means, if you can live in a nice, decent neighborhood and live in a place that has very few windows, just turn the lights on. It's not such a terrible life. And yet the regulation will not allow it. And I'm curious as to what extent is it making it more difficult to convert office buildings to apartments?
Yeah. Right. I'm sure there's probably plenty of regulations that might impede that conversion, because maybe some regulation about toilets and plumbing and, you know, whatever else that might pose some kind of barrier. Of course, as you said, it seems that there's also been some discussion about what's happening with commercial real estate, especially with maybe more people working from home now, that maybe commercial real estate, maybe there's not as much of a business case for it as there used to be, and maybe there's a structural difference now. So,
indeed, yeah. No, and it seems as though it's here to stay. That I think if this was the lockdowns were a huge humanitarian tragedy, The one thing I liked about the lockdowns is that the teachers unions behaved like such pigs that parents rebelled, and there's been a huge turn away from teachers union dominated public schools to homeschooling and to charter schools. That's been one good result. If the other result is that the laptop class, obviously a lot of people do have to go to work, likes to stay home and commercial real estate is no longer viable, then to what extent can we convert that real estate to residences? That's the logical alternative. Although, by the way, I know a number of people who are not too happy working at home, and that's been another fallout where businesses are not maintaining offices and they miss the social life. So maybe there will be a little bit of a turn back to working. But if indeed a lot of people want to work from home and not commute, that in itself is nothing that you and I can object to. We can only hope that government gets, they're providing tax incentives for commercial real estate to convert to residences. But I rarely hear what you and I were just talking about, the easing of regulations that make it possible for people to have the options. I've opened up a building and it's tiny apartments and half of them don't have windows. But obviously my rents are very low. Do you want to live there? You know, it's not such a tragedy to live in an apartment without a window. But apparently from the standpoint of the regulators, it's not permitted. So that's part of the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's probably a good spot to finish up here, Gene, but we've spoken about a lot of things, your critique.
If you had this other question, how should one try to get ahead in today's day and age? We haven't covered that, I guess, some other time. I managed to talk about the Soul Forum enough. Go into thesoulforum.org. In March, by the way, I've done 9 debates at my Soul Forum. We've had 87 debates since our inception in September of 2016. I've done 9 of them. One of them with a socialist has gotten 6.3 million YouTube views, and with socialist Richard Wolf. And I'm proud of that one because I think it's partly he must be the celebrity who's brought it up to 6.3 million. This is an amazing figure. It's one. Some other debates we've had have 100,000, 200,000, but nothing like 6 million. I'm debating a journalist named Jonas Serra in March. He wrote a book against the lockdowns, but his argument is that capitalism was a big reason why the lockdowns were imposed. That once again, when in doubt, blame it on capitalism. And so I'm debating him on that issue.
Right.
I don't really think capitalism is to blame for the lockdowns, but this is a popular book, and I thought I'd debate him on that. So that's going to be me in March. So, Stefan, I hope to see you in New York and at the after party with your wife and your 9-month-old son.
Yeah, well, we'll see. It's a long way to travel, Dubai to New York, but Maybe we'll wait. We'll make it out sometime. So look, I think that's a great spot to finish up. Gene, thank you for joining me. I will put the links in the show notes. So just a reminder, that's thesohoforum.org for people who want to catch Gene and check out some of the debates. I recommend them. I've seen some of them online. I have not, sadly, not been in person, but I hope to someday. So Gene, thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for your perceptive questions that brought out my ire, but hopefully we gained some insight. Thanks again. Bye-bye.